the Zionist regime's weaponization of its tech industry and the global use of its spyware offerings by regimes and security agencies around the world must be addressed, especially because it has been explicitly weaponized to prevent nonviolent boycotts of Israeli regime's occupation of Palestine, including those solely based on humanitarian grounds or out of respect for international laws that the Zionist regime routinely breaks. Allowing a government to engage in this activity on a global scale to stifle criticism of flagrantly illegal policies and war crimes cannot continue, and this should be the case for any government, not just the fake regime of Israel. If the outlets eagerly reporting on the latest Pegasus revelations are truly concerned with the abuse of spyware by regimes and intelligence agencies around the world, they should also give attention to Toka, as it is actively arming these same institutions with the weapons far worse than any NSO group product.
After 20 years in the country, the United States withdrew its forces from Afghanistan. U.S. President Joe Biden announced that the remaining U.S. servicemen and women would be gone by September 11th.
The plan has long been in together, out together. U.S. troops, as well as forces deployed by our NATO allies and operational partners, will be out of Afghanistan before we mark the 20th anniversary that heinous attack on September 11th.
The date was significant, and although the withdrawal was completed earlier than that, still, what Biden said was exactly 20 years after the 9/11 attacks on America, which Washington claimed was planned and directed from Afghanistan.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
American troops invaded Afghanistan looking for Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, claiming the government of Afghanistan was sheltering him. They promised to drive out both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. 20 long years later, the U.S. war in Afghanistan is officially over. And while the focus is presently on how the Biden administration prosecuted the chaotic withdrawal, those false assurances are merely the latest in the long series that has marked America's longest war. In fact, with the invasion now over, it's worth taking stock of just how it was sold to not only the American people, but to the rest of the world. The big upshot of the present situation is that the Taliban, which the United States went to war to uproot, is back in charge in the country immediately upon the withdrawal. That's something Washington had promised time and time again wouldn't happen. In fact, in the early years of the invasion, the Bush administration spoke of the Taliban as if it had been utterly obliterated. It repeatedly used the word eliminated. In April 2002, Condoleezza Rice, then White House National Security Advisor, said, "With the Taliban eliminated and Al-Qaeda badly damaged, we have moved into the second stage of our war on terror." In November 2003, Bush used similar language. In September 2004, Bush declared that as a result of the United States military, the Taliban no longer is in existence. Even at the time, this flew in the face of the evidence, given that civilians and foreign troops were still being attacked and killed. By 2008, what Bush said was still the case, so the outgoing president claimed he never said the Taliban was eliminated.
The Taliban was brutalizing the people of Afghanistan, and they're not in power. And I just cited the progress that is undeniable. Now, is there more work to be done? You bet. I never said the Taliban was eliminated. I said they were removed from power.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair made the same mistake as well. In 2012, when he was asked whether the Taliban is able to come back to power after a US withdrawal, he said it's unlikely. Now, some might argue that everyone might make wrong predictions, but it was about the lives of millions in Afghanistan. So there's a huge difference between a president talking with such certainty and an ordinary man. The cost of this 20-year military invasion has been astronomically high in lives, in livelihoods, and in money. The U.S. Central Command Combined Air Operations Center says the U.S. Air Force dropped a record 7,423 bombs on Afghanistan. This is more than at any time in the last 10 years. Over 2,300 U.S. soldiers were killed and more than 20,000 injured. But it is the Afghans themselves who have borne the brunt of the casualties, with over 60,000 members of the security forces killed and as many as 170,000 civilians. The estimated financial cost to the U.S. taxpayer is close to a staggering $1 trillion U.S. dollars. So the awkward question that has to be asked is, was it all worth it? The truth is, during two decades of occupation, the US achieved very little. Some say despite being unable to drive out the Taliban, terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Daesh were eliminated. But that's a false claim. These groups have not disappeared. They are resurgent and doubtless encouraged by the imminent departure of the last remaining Western forces. What happened in the Kabul airport last month is proof of their existence. Violence still rages on in the country, with dozens of Afghans getting killed each year. The research group Action on Armed Violence says 2020 saw more Afghans killed by explosive devices than in any other country in the world. Washington didn't manage to drive out the Taliban. Instead, the militant group is now introducing a new government. The occupation of Afghanistan, in fact, ended with the next Republican president, who cut a deal with the Taliban, and that president's Democratic successor then cited as the reason for the withdrawal. That Democratic successor, Joe Biden, and his administration have their own trail of false claims, including that the Taliban wouldn't return to power so quickly.
Is a Taliban takeover of Afghanistan now inevitable?
No, it is not. Because you have the Afghan troops at 300,000, well-equipped as any army in the world, and an air force, against something like 75,000 Taliban. It is not inevitable.
100% we lost the war. I mean, the Taliban already taken over one of the major passes, like this week, and getting money from this choke point of Tajikistan. So, and we're not even out yet. Like, the Taliban will take over. It's who's going to be there to stop them, you know? Like, so the whole point was to get rid of the Taliban. We didn't do that. I mean, really make it really simple. Did we do that? No.
The current U.S. administration was also confident that there would be no scenes like those in Vietnam, where a chaotic withdrawal required people to be airlifted from the U.S. embassy in Saigon.
I remember standing in front of the American embassy in Saigon after the fall and having a young woman come up to me with her American identification card and saying, they left me behind. They betrayed me. Why did they do this? You see the same scenario playing out today.
A strikingly similar situation transpired in Kabul. After the Taliban returned, many Afghans kept asking themselves, wasn't the purpose of invasion the elimination of insurgency? The United States gave massive concessions to the Taliban, and at the end of the day, Washington recognized the group they once wanted to destroy. Observers believe by admitting the Taliban, the U.S. is admitting its failure in Afghanistan.
We lost 20 years. We lost the war. We lost everything. As simple as that. We have to go back. We have to withdraw.
Now the situation is the same as it was 20 years ago. I'm not sure that spending 20 years there solved any problems at all.
20 years of war and what the U.S. government insisted to call nation building did not produce the political aims that Washington was after. The reason is simple. Afghanistan's fate was never going to be determined by foreigners coming from thousands of miles away.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
May 7th, 2021. During the revolutionary movement, some were telling Imam Khomeini, may God be pleased with him, that he was causing the best young people to get killed. Look at these pressures that are brought in the form of prudence and caution. This is the great and beautiful patience that Imam Hussein had. And then his companions are killed one by one in that horrible situation. This is like someone whose body is cut up into pieces little by little. It was like this for Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura. It was not like a bomb that fell and killed some people. No, every one of his companions who was killed, every one of the members of his household who was killed, it was as if a part of the Imam's blessed body was cut off. And the Imam was patient during each of these events, one by one. He sipped at patience, drop by drop. This movement was this great, and the result was clear. As a result, those values that Imam Hussein wanted to remain in the world remained. The Quran, the name of Islam, the values of Islam, the traditions of the Prophet, and in a more limited and important way, Shiism, which is the school of the household of the Prophet, all remained. Subhanallah, if Imam Hussein had not acted in this way, the situation would have been different and all of Islam would have been destroyed. It would have been destroyed in the same way that during the 50 or 60 years after the demise of the Prophet. Islam had changed to the point where they could kill the dearest member of the family of the Prophet. Well, the situation had changed significantly. I have already explained this matter in detail one time. The Islamic world had reached the point where they could openly kill or take captive Imam Hussein, Lady Zainab al-Kubra, the children of the Prophet, and the dearest family of the Prophet. The situation must have changed significantly, and afterwards, in a short time, it could have gotten even worse, and Islam could have been completely eliminated. In fact, Imam Hussein acted like a huge stake that held down the tent of Islam, which a storm was uprooting. He kept it with his blood. Well, this is the greatest epic in the history of Islam, even the greatest epic throughout all of history. This must be preserved. This must be kept alive. This should be used for solving all the affairs of the Muslims, wherever they are in history.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe, is hosting another summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The bloc, which was founded 20 years ago, is a rapidly expanding Eurasian security and economic body led by Russia and China. It has now officially given Iran full membership in this edition of Spotlight. We'll discuss the different aspects of this unanimous decision as well as the significance of such a bloc known as the Alliance of the East at the time of growing tensions with the West.
Nations Heads of State Summit is being held in the Tajik capital, Dushanbe. Since its foundation 20 years ago, the Eurasian bloc has defined itself as a multilateral organization concentrated on fighting terrorism and extremism, ensuring regional peace and stability, and increasing economic cooperation. The SCO is the largest regional organization in the world in terms of population and territorial coverage. It is home to almost half of the world's population, and its members own nearly a quarter of the global GDP. In the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, SCO is a leading player in regional diplomacy with firm commitments to inclusive multilateralism.
The SCO is a leading player in regional diplomacy, promoting multilateralism and fostering cooperation to address the most pressing peace and security issues in Eurasia. The organization represents the largest combined population of any regional grouping in the world, over 3 billion women and men, more than half of them children and young people.
The SCO members have made significant achievements over the past years in different fields. In 2021, the foreign trade volume of the bloc reached $6.6 trillion, which is 100 times as much as it was 20 years ago. The total economic value of the bloc also stands close to $20 trillion, more than 13 times higher than its initial amount. Moreover, statistics show between 2013 and 2017, the SCO institutions have made great contributions to the global fight against terrorism by preventing hundreds of crimes and arresting thousands of members of terrorist organizations. The successful interaction of the bloc's members has even resulted in the creation of a political term, the Shanghai Spirit, a concept that highlights the association's main principles: decision-making based on mutual respect, equal dialogue, and consideration of the interests of all member states. These principles have paved the way for the development of the organization and the expansion of its influence to such an extent that today, at the time of growing unilateralism across the world, one can consider the SCO a success story of coexistence of diverse states with different ethnic and cultural traditions.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have John Roth, Senior Fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies. And also joining us from Potsdam, Germany, we have Harley Schlanger, who is a member of the Board of Directors of the Schiller Institute.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ross in London. How significant is the full membership of Iran to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Oh, well, I think it's very significant because what this means is that it extends the geographical extent of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization into West Asia, and it means that it covers a much, much greater geographical distance. So this is now a very solid region of support and stability in the world against terrorism, against pressure by the United States, and against all sorts of threats. So this is a very significant positive development.
Mr. Shanger, over to you. In Potsdam, Iran's membership at the SCO, what are the implications for Iran across the board, economically, diplomatically, and et cetera?
Well, it has profound implications in all areas, including the counterterrorism. But I think the one I'd like to focus on is the economic and diplomatic, because part of what was discussed at the SCO meeting today was how to deal with the situation, the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. And the fact that you have most of Afghanistan's neighbors there talking about cooperation, about economic development, not about punishing the country that's already been punished by literally 40 years of war, but the fact that Iran is being included in this is a recognition of the role that Iran can play as part of a stabilizing force in a part of the world that has been subject to destabilization over and over in the recent period.
Mr. Ross, the Iranian president has promised a more comprehensive, quote-unquote, look to the east. This seems to be a step in that direction, isn't it, in your opinion?
Well, yes, certainly. What is happening, you see two processes which are overlapping. Iran, the way it expresses it, is look to the east. That is against the type of unilateral sanctions and threats which have come from the United States and which unfortunately have not been resisted enough by Europe. Europe doesn't go on along with it enough, but nevertheless, unfortunately, hasn't been resisted. And you have then the Belt and Road Initiative, which has come from China, or which is going westwards from China. So, and the two are meeting in the middle. So therefore, you have the coming together of a combined vision, which is coming out of Iran, coming out of China, and coming out of other countries in there. Then that means also that you have certainly very strongly counter terrorist efforts, etc., coming out of Russia and other countries in the region. So you've got a serious force for stability in a very large part of the world. So this is very good news, both economically and diplomatically, and also for any fight against terrorism. And I agree very much after the situation in Afghanistan, where the United States has just suffered a catastrophic result, and this will help to stabilize the situation, with Iran entering into this alliance which goes across the whole region.
Mr. Shanger, in his remarks, the Iranian president, Mr. Raisi, asserted that Iran, his country's foreign policy, is based on opposition to unilateralism, expressing hope that the SCO will become a driving force of global multilateralism. Can you unpack those comments for us, please?
Sure. I mean, what we've seen since the fall of the Soviet Union is the belief among especially Western leaders, largely in NATO, the United Kingdom, and the United States, the belief that the West won the war, and the idea of a rules-based order, which we hear from Secretary of State Blinken all the time, is that the West now makes the rules. Now, these are rules not about peace and stability, but about economic policy, about who can do what. The idea of a rules-based order that tolerates the kinds of wars that have been launched unilaterally, for example, against Libya, against Iraq, against Syria, defending the terrorists in Syria. This is what unilateralism means, the idea that the so-called winners can assert the policy. Now, on the other side, the idea of multilateralism is find means of mutually beneficial cooperation. This is what Xi Jinping of China means by win-win, that you operate on the principle that other nations, instead of competing over scarce resources, work together to develop new kinds of development projects, which is the basis for peace. And I think the important thing is that one of the other things about the SCO is that in collaboration with institutions such as the Asian Development Bank, the China Development Bank, the BRICS Bank, you actually are beginning to put together a certain amount of seed capital to fund these kinds of projects that are the basis of peace, again, based on multilateralism, not unilateral dictates.
Mr. Ross, as a bloc, how do you perceive the functionality of the SCO? What can it do for the region?
Well, the most fundamental question of the SCO is what you might call military political. That's its origins. That is, it's to get rid of any forms of aggression, to get rid of terrorism, and to get rid of unilateral actions by countries outside. Now, within that framework, then it's possible to build economic relations. One will hope that will happen. Certainly the fact that all the countries in the bloc are against unilateral US economic sanctions is helpful. So it's the most fundamental is that it's a geopolitical military bloc, but it then contains certain important potentials economically, and in particular it goes against the sanctions which are going against Iran. So the fact that it's been admitted into the bloc, which is clearly against the wishes of the United States, shows the solidarity of the other countries within the region against Iran, which will aid regional stability, and hopefully the economic purposes will also develop further within that.
Mr. Schlinger, President Raisi also said, quote, today world peace and security are threatened by hegemony and challenges such as terrorism, extremism, and separatism. Those are some of the issues that you mentioned as well. He also said maintaining and strengthening peace across Asia is not a choice, but a necessity. Does an organization like the SCO fall into bringing about that necessity?
Oh, sure. I mean, because if you look at some of the outstanding issues besides Afghanistan, you have two members, India and Pakistan, both nuclear armed and often at odds with each other. The India-China relationship has not been so good in recent years. However, they share a common interest in economic development of their countries, and importantly, in the idea of sovereignty, which fits in with this question of non-interference of other countries. The SCO has made a big point of this, that there should not be interference in the internal affairs, and that their negotiations and discussions and diplomacy is to enhance the kind of agreements that will allow sovereign nations to work together for mutual benefit. And I think that's really the key to security. What we learned from Afghanistan is that you can't bring peace by war. I don't know if that's been fully understood by the military-industrial complex in the United States, which seems to be itching for a confrontation either with Russia or China. But I think the fact that you have this kind of broad alliance that the SCO represents is an impediment to the unilateral demands or unilateral dreams of the restoring the old geopolitical empire of the Anglo-Americans.
Right. Well, Mr. Ross, I guess that we spoke to earlier here on Press TV on the same issue, had this to say. He said we could be seeing the dawn of a new phase of unity in the Eurasian region, specifically with the ugly exit of the U.S. from Afghanistan. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, I think Afghanistan shows that the policy of the United States over the last 20 years or more has been a total failure. I mean, what has happened in Afghanistan is widely pointed out, is that the United States invaded, it spent $2.3 trillion to get rid of the Taliban, and the Taliban is back in power. You can regard that either as a good or a bad thing, but it's a total failure of the policy of the United States. Therefore, what the SCO is based on is the exact opposite of that, which is you cannot remake a country from outside that by interference in its internal affairs. This is a disastrous failure of the United States. It produces either defeat, as in Afghanistan, or it reduces chaos, as an example, has developed in Libya. So therefore, that's one of the most important things of the SCO. Though doubtless these countries will have various problems and differences and so on and so forth, but they are not subject to the type of fundamentally destabilizing projects which affect the whole of the world, as we've seen with the situation in the United States' intervention in various countries in the region. That's why the SCO is very, very important region. It's a very, very large area of the world in which you don't have this type of intervention, or which is against this type of intervention by the United States.
Right. Mr. Schlanger, you mentioned the issue of sanctions earlier. The Iranian president called the sanctions a big challenge to the world today, saying that domineering states have been using them as a tool to impose their will over others. He also added the sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. How can an organization like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization tackle these challenges, for example, the unilateral sanctions?
Well, let's take one specific example, the so-called Caesar sanctions that have been imposed against Syria. These sanctions say not only that individuals will be hit with financial penalties and seizure of accounts and so on, but that any nation or company that engages in reconstruction in Syria will be penalized to the full extent of the law. Now, that's a violation of every human rights ordinance that is on the books. Now, what can something like the SCO do? Well, you have a question now where the U.S. is imposing these sanctions on Syria. At the same time, it's occupying the oil fields and a lot of the wheat-growing area, and the people of Syria are suffering badly. The Russians did something interesting. They started a means of bringing in food. We just saw the other day the Iranians bring oil to Lebanon. When you have countries that have a commitment to work together, they can find ways to do this. Now, what's the recourse that the sanction imposer can do? Go to war? I mean, at this point, as Professor Ross just pointed out, wars don't work to do this. All they do is destroy. So I think that the ability to get together and work out through discussion process a way of economic cooperation and collaboration is a way around the sanctions. And it will create immediately a confrontation, but that's the kind of confrontation that's necessary because I think at this point, the recourse to war is something that, even in the United States, the American people don't want more wars.
Mr. Ross, President Raisi, he condemned the U.S. for causing chaos in the region, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said Washington needs to be able to account for what it has done in Afghanistan over the past two decades. Also in clear opposition to foreign interference, he stressed that the sole way to establishing security in the region is through regional cooperation. Here, we can insert the SCO, a.k.a. The Alliance of the East. Tell us more.
Well, but this is obviously correct. I mean, look at the record of the United States interventions. What have you produced? You had invasion of Iraq. This produced total destruction in Iraq and previously very marginal terrorist organizations instead became very powerful. If you look at the situation in Afghanistan, the United States intervened. It spent $2.3 trillion, according to the best estimates, as a result of which is that it was actually military defeated. In Libya, which used to be the richest, most prosperous country in Africa, you now have the open selling of human slaves in Libya and economic chaos. What has this produced? This has produced absolutely catastrophic results. And it just shows you cannot interfere from outside another country's affairs. Countries have their internal equilibrium, their internal forces. Sometimes mistakes will be made. No country in the world is perfect. But the intervention from the outside, invariably, as shown by the United States, produces absolutely disastrous results. And the SCO is against this and is the main regional bulwark of stability in a very large part of the world. Therefore, the inclusion of Iran in this is a very positive situation. Unfortunately, despite these disasters which have occurred with US policies, it's not at all clear that they've learned this lesson. But then the SCO is a powerful bulwark against this type of disaster being foisted on the world. And of course, these types of negative effects they're bad enough, most worse, for the countries in which they occur, but then they also lead to the spread of international terrorism and other things which can destabilize whole regions. This whole policy by the United States has been absolutely disastrous.
Mr. Schlanger, final comments on the issue. The Iranian president stressed that the sole way to establishing security in the region is through regional cooperation. How big of a role can the SCO, which is also known as the Alliance of the East, play in such an equation?
Well, it can play a huge role. I mean, first of all, the whole world needs development. We're teetering on a global financial disaster, economic collapse, again, coming from the same unilateralist policies. The role of the International Monetary Fund to suppress development. The idea to justify intervention under something like Tony Blair's responsibility to protect has been a disaster. Now, what happens when you get powerful nations such as Russia and China, and I would include Iran in that, which has a very important role to play. What happens when those nations show that you can work together? You can overcome disagreements through dialogue, but you can act in concert for the development of the people that are in your neighborhood. And that's initially what the SCO was set out to do, to take a situation that was somewhat chaotic in the region around the collapse of the Soviet Union and bring stability. Now, where was the terrorism coming from? A lot of it was from the outside. And by working together, you create an environment of trust. And that's something that's totally lacking. And just very quickly, what the US and the UK did with the submarine deal with Australia shattered the trust of many in Europe that they could work with the United Kingdom and the United States. So I think the example that can be set by the SCO will have a powerful effect on the whole world.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Let's leave it there. Thanks to my guest, John Ross, Senior Fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies, joining us from London. And thanks to Harley Schlanger, member of the Board of Directors at the Schiller Institute, speaking to us from Potsdam, Germany. Also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
While Europe's right-wing parties remain committed to the ridiculous and baseless notion that Muslims, immigrants, and refugees pose a threat to Europe's overall security and unique secular identities, the left is not entirely immune from such chauvinistic notions, says Ramzi Baruth, journalist, in an article published under the heading Progress or War on Islamophobia and Europe's Demographic Shifts. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Europe's identity crisis is not confined to the ceaseless squabbles by Europeans over the EU, Brexit, or football. It goes much deeper, reaching sensitive and dangerous territory, including that of culture and religion. Once more, Muslims stand at the heart of the continent's identity debate. Of course, anti-Muslim sentiments are rarely framed to appear anti-Muslim. While Europe's right-wing parties remain committed to the ridiculous and baseless notion that Muslims, immigrants, and refugees pose a threat to Europe's overall security and unique secular identities, the left is not entirely immune from such chauvinistic notions. The right's political discourse is familiar and is often condemned for its repugnantly ultra-nationalistic, if not outright racist, tone and rhetoric. The left, on the other hand, is a different story. The European left, notably in countries like France and Belgium, framed their problem with Islam as fundamental to their supposed dedication to the secular values of the state. A problem arises when, in the name of religion, some want to separate themselves from the Republic and therefore not respect its laws, Macron said during a speech in October 2020. Leftist politicians and intellectuals were just as eager as the right to prevent Ihsan Houg, a Belgian government representative, from serving as a commissioner at the Institute for the Equality of Women and Men, IEFH. Again, both sides joined forces, although without an official declaration of unity, to ensure Houg had no place in the country's democratic process. It was a repeat of a similar scenario in France last May, when Sarah Zemahi was removed from the ruling party's candidates list for seemingly violating France's valeurs de la République, or the values of the Republic. These are but mere examples and are badly and hardly restricted to French-speaking countries. There are many such disquieting events pointing to a deep-seated problem that remains unresolved. In Britain, Rachia Ismail was celebrated as the country's first hijab-wearing mayor in May 2019, resigned from her post less than a year and a half later, citing racism and marginalization. While the Belgian, French, and British media elaborated on these stories as if unique to each specific country, in truth, they are all related. Indeed, they are all the outcome of an overriding phenomenon of an anti-Muslim prejudice coupled with a wave of racism that has plagued Europe for many years, especially in the last decade. Though Europe's official institutions, mainstream media, sports clubs, and so on continue to pay lip service to the need for diversity and inclusion, the reality on the ground is entirely different. A recent example was the horrific outcome of England's defeat in the Euro 2020 final against Italy. Gangs of white English, mostly males, attack people of color, especially black people, whether on the street or online. The extent of cyberbullying, in particular targeting dark-skinned athletes, is almost unprecedented in country's recent history. Various British officials, including Prime Minister Boris Johnson, condemned the widespread racism. Interestingly, many of these officials have said or done very little to combat anti-Muslim hate and violence in the past, which often targeted Muslim women for their head or face covering. Strikingly, Johnson, purportedly now leading the anti-racist charge, was one of the most disparaging officials who spoke demandingly of Muslim women in the past. Of course, Islamophobia must be seen within the larger context of the toxic anti-refugee and anti-immigrant sentiments now defining factors in shaping modern European politics. It is this hate and racism that served as the fuel for rising political parties like Le Front National in France, Vlaams Belang in Belgium, the Freedom Party in Austria, and the Liga in Italy. In fact, there is a whole intellectual discourse complete with brand new theories that are used to channel yet more hate, violence, and racism against immigrants. And where is the left in all of this? With a few exceptions, much of the left is still trapped in its own intellectual hobby, adding yet more fuel to the fire, while veiling their criticism of Islam as if genuine concern for the secularism. Oddly, in Europe, as in much of the West, crosses and stars of David as necklaces or the Catholic nun's head covering Velo del Sor, let alone the kippahs, the religious tattoos, and many other such symbols are all part of Europe's everyday culture. Why do we never hear of such controversy of a Jewish man being tossed out of a public building because of his kippah, or a white French woman being expelled from university for wearing a cross? The matter has less to do with religious symbols in general than of the religious symbols of races and peoples who are simply unwanted in Europe. Also, limiting the discussion to refugees and immigrants may give the impression that the debate is mostly concerned with the non-European others who are invading Europe's shores, determined to replace Europe's original white Christian inhabitants. This is hardly the case, since a sizable percentage of Belgians and French, for example, are themselves Muslims, estimated at 6% and 5% respectively. Namely, these Muslims are European citizens. Ouch, Zemahi and Ismail actually wanted to be a part of, not break apart from, these societies by honoring their country's most cherished political traditions, yet without erasing their own cultural heritage and religious identities in the process. Alas, they were all vehemently rejected, as if Europe has made a collective decision to ensure that Muslims subsist in the margins forever. And when Muslim communities try to fight back using Europe's own judicial system as their supposed saviors, they are once again rejected. The latest of such spans was in June, when Belgium's constitutional court resolved that prohibiting the wearing of hijab does not constitute a violation of freedom of religion or the right to education. It is time for European countries to understand that their demographics are fundamentally changing, and that such change can, in fact, be beneficial to the health of these nations. Without the true diversity and meaningful inclusion, there can be no real progress in any society anywhere. But while demographic shifts can offer an opportunity for growth, it can also inspire fear, racism, and predictably violence as well. Europe, which has fought two horrendous wars in the last century, should know better.